With no sign that the severe drought here in California will ease up anytime soon, more and more farmers and ranchers are pumping groundwater to keep their businesses afloat. In the state's farm-rich Central Valley, a record number of permits are being issued to drill new wells. But as KQED's Sasha Coca reports, water experts are warning that without regulation, the state's groundwater reserves could be sucked dry.
Steve Arthur practically lives out of his truck these days. He runs one of Fresno's busiest well drilling companies and hustles up and down the highway to check on drilling rigs that run 24 hours a day.
It's officially getting crazy. We go and go, but it just seems like we can't go fast enough.
He says he's lucky if he gets 3 hours of sleep a night.
There's just so much going on with these crews running through the night that there's always a problem someplace.
Arthur says his company's got an 8-month waiting list.
I mean, it's just amazing the amount of people that call and want wells. A customer called me this morning, and I'm supposed to do 2 for him. He said add 14 to the list.
You have to literally grab these guys and drag them to your property and say, please, please drill me a well.
That's farmer Matt Fisher, who's been scrambling to keep his orange trees alive after learning he won't get any water this year from federal reservoirs.
I've even heard of drilling companies that won't tell growers who's in front of them because guys are even trying to buy the other guy's spot in line. If you have to pay a guy $10,000 for his spot in line, that's cheap compared to what you're going to lose if you lose your whole orchard.
It's not always about losing trees. Right where a brand new almond orchard will be planted, a drilling rig bores a hole in the earth 2,500 feet deep. All told, this well will cost the farmer about $1 million.
Esto le llamamos el doghouse.
Juan de la Cruz works on this rig 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, carefully guiding the drill bit. He's standing in a little shack next to the drill hole that they call the doghouse, where workers keep a log of the layers of sand and clay they find. 2 other essential pieces of gear, a microwave and a fridge.
Hay nopales, hay zucchinis.
We've got some cactus and zucchini in here to cook up, De La Cruz says. The farmers bring us cantaloupes, tomatoes, whatever we want. They're so grateful because when we're done with this well, these fields will have water.
Ya terminaron pozo de estos, todos estos fields van a tener agua ya.
Bob Zimmerer, who owns this rig, says California's drought is profitable for well drillers. For now.
I mean, we can't keep sustaining this amount of overdraft. We all know that. At this point in time, we don't want to keep on going on at this pace. It's more of a temporary fix.
That's a sobering admission from a well driller. California's aquifers supply 40% of the state's water in normal years, but in this drought year, it could be as high as 65%. State officials estimate water tables in some parts of the Central Valley have dropped 100 feet below historical lows. Groundwater pumping could also put more stress on the San Andreas Fault, whose moving plates can cause earthquakes. And those aren't the only consequences.
We're on a one-way trajectory towards depletion, towards running out of groundwater.
That's Jay Famlietti, a University of California hydrologist and a leading expert on groundwater. He points out California's the only Western state that doesn't really monitor or regulate how much groundwater is pumped.
So it's not unlike having several straws in a glass and everyone drinking at the same time and no one really watching the level.
That could change. A bill making its way through the California legislature could, for the first time ever, require local agencies to track and in some cases even restrict groundwater pumping. Some farmers oppose it, saying it's a violation of their private property rights. For NPR News, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
Now to a kind of heritage site here in the U.S., Yosemite National Park is celebrating the 150th anniversary of the law that preserved it. In 1864, Abraham Lincoln signed the Yosemite Grant Act, which planted the seeds for the national park system. For the last century and a half, visitors have been enjoying the natural wonders of Yosemite and California's Sierra Nevada, from Half Dome to the giant Sequoia Grove. But 4 million visitors a year have made preservation difficult. Sasha Coca of member station KQED has this report from Yosemite.
It's nearing midnight, and the full moon is bathing North America's tallest waterfall in its milky glow. A few photographers have timed their visit to Yosemite so they can catch a glimpse of a rare phenomenon that's only visible when the moonlight catches the mist at the base of Yosemite Falls.
Well, that is really good.
Oh, that's great.
We're here taking the moonbow, which is basically a rainbow at night.
Photographer Mark Zabrowski explains that the naked eye just sees a thin silvery band of moonbow, but a long exposure with a camera can capture the color.
Just a spectacular view. You know, you can look up and you can see the ridges up high and the stars. It fills your eyes, you know, and it gives you a lot to feed off of.
Photography, in fact, has been key to Yosemite's allure. Historians think it may have helped convince President Abraham Lincoln to preserve a place he'd never visited.
The first photographer who came to the Mariposa Grove in 1859 took a picture of the grizzly giant from the angle that we're looking at today.
Ranger and park historian Dean Schenck walks towards one of Yosemite's most famous trees.
The grizzly giant is in the neighborhood of the size of the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
This grove of giant sequoias and Yosemite's iconic valley became the first federally protected wilderness areas when Lincoln signed the grant on June 30th, 1864.
In the midst of our country's Civil War, with all the bloodshed, all the battle, all the anxiety, many of us would like to think that he took a moment and perhaps shook his head or smiled and just perhaps a sigh of pleasure.
Schenck compares the idea of protecting these lands to the seed of a giant sequoia, which is as tiny as an oat flake.
And so that seed planted by Lincoln's signature has expanded to the national park system throughout America.
But Schenck points out, even those who urged Congress and Lincoln to preserve Yosemite warned that tourism had to be managed carefully. That includes Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect who helped design New York's Central Park and helped oversee the Yosemite land grant.
Not only did he predict the millions of people in the future, but he also said, and so we must be aware of the capricious damage that one visitor might make and then multiply it by the millions.
I live right here on the highway that goes to Yosemite. So I see these buses go and go.
Helen Hogan Coates was born in Yosemite in 1927. She's one of the oldest surviving Native Americans to grow up in the park.
And I tell my husband, there they go again. They're trampling down my ground again. They're just trampling her down. I said, why don't they give her a rest? They're making it into a Disneyland.
Coates worked in the hotel laundry, washing sheets, and as a babysitter for the children of Ansel Adams, the famed Yosemite photographer. She says she hopes visitors coming to commemorate Yosemite's history will stop for a while to think about what this place was like before white settlers arrived a century and a half ago.
I mean, don't just come in there and have a good time, you know, celebrating. You got to have a little spiritual way at looking at the rocks and the trees.
All aboard! All aboard!
Soon, the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias will be a little less like Disneyland. The trams that snake through the trees on paved roads and the parking lots built right on top of some of the sequoias' delicate roots will soon be removed. So will the gift shop. National Park officials plan to restore the grove as part of the anniversary celebration. Tourists will have to walk through the trees, much as the first visitors to Yosemite did 150 years ago. For NPR News, I'm Sasha Coca.
Early tomorrow morning, NASA will launch a satellite capable of monitoring carbon dioxide emissions from space. It's seen as critical to understanding global warming. Tomorrow's launch is actually a second attempt by researchers. They tried to carry out the same mission 5 years ago. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, this time they're confident it'll work.
Carbon dioxide coming from power plants and tailpipes is the main reason our planet is warming. Scientists have been obsessively watching CO2 levels rise for decades, but the way they do it hasn't changed. David Crisp is a researcher at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California.
Since about 1958, we've been making very, very precise measurements of carbon dioxide by essentially filling bottles full of air, shipping them to Boulder, Colorado, primarily these days, and running it through a series of very, very sensitive laboratory instruments.
The samples show carbon dioxide levels are creeping up, but they can't tell scientists exactly where all that CO2 is coming from.
We don't have these snapshots that really show what's happening right now over, let's say, all of Texas.
Stephen Wofsy is an atmospheric scientist at Harvard University. What researchers would like is a picture of carbon dioxide as it rises from smokestacks. And that's why many are excited about a satellite that can survey CO2 from space.
People have been waiting for this now for a really long time. It's going to change the way we track and understand CO2 emissions.
David Crisp, the guy you heard at the beginning, actually led the team that built this satellite. He called it the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, or OCO. It could measure tiny changes in CO2 from high in orbit. Amazing, considering carbon dioxide is an invisible gas. And actually, it launched in 2009.
T-minus 10, 9, 8.
We had what looked like an absolutely gorgeous launch.
Zero. And liftoff of the Taurus rocket with OCO, tracking a greenhouse gas in seek of clues to global warming.
But about 3.5 minutes in came a problem. The rocket's nose cone didn't come off.
In all stations, it appears we've had a contingency with the OCO mission.
The nose cone weighed the rocket down, and Crisp watched his precious satellite fall back to Earth.
I felt like somebody had rolled a concussion grenade into the room and that it had gone off.
10 months later, a depressed Crisp was woken up in the middle of the night.
About 2 o'clock in the morning, I got a call from the White House.
The Obama administration had decided the mission was so valuable it would pay for a carbon copy, the Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2. Crisp spent another 4 years building it. In the meantime, cities, particularly in the developing world, have been growing. The growth is so fast that scientists are losing track of emissions.
The largest single uncertainty in our understanding of the emission of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere is now the burning of fossil fuels.
OCO2 is only an experiment. The picture it makes will be very fuzzy, and it won't be able to look at every city on the planet. But it might lead to satellites that could, and that could be useful for enforcing future global warming treaties. All that will only happen if the new OCO2 works. Will it?
We very rarely have an opportunity to build something twice. We had that opportunity this time. So we used a lot of extra care. So we have a lot of confidence.
But just in case, Crisp will be standing in the control room one more time to see the mission through. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Scientists announced earlier this week they had discovered three supermassive black holes orbiting close together in a single galaxy. That indicates that black holes are more common than astronomers previously thought. And it's a good reason to revisit a report from Joe Palca on black holes. In this Encore segment, he reports that the theories about these super powerful bodies are still, well, full of holes.
Astronomers know a few things about black holes. On the other hand, Ensign Chekhov and Mr. Spock seem to know all about them.
They're creating a singularity that will consume the planet.
They're creating a black hole at the center of Vulcan?
Yes, sir.
Sure, why not? Let's make a black hole. Well, it's not that simple, actually. So, what do real scientists know about black holes?
A black hole is a region of space where the pull of gravity is so intense that nothing can escape it, not even light.
Andrea Ghez is an astronomer at UCLA. And yes, a black hole would suck in a planet if it got too close. Since light can't escape from a black hole, you can't actually see them. But you know they're there by observing the stars nearby.
So very much like the planets going around the sun, a black hole will force stars around it to orbit.
And by studying those orbits, you can figure out where the black hole is and how massive it is. That's how Ghez and others discovered a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way. But black holes pose a paradox. Although they're massive, they take up no space. In other words, something with the mass of a star, but in a space infinitesimally smaller than a pinhead. The laws of quantum mechanics and general relativity break down when trying to explain how black holes work. So let's get real.
Nobody really understands what a black hole is.
It'll be a while before Gez and her scientific colleagues catch up with the Star Trek crew. Joe Palca, NPR News.
You know, it's not often we conduct interviews underwater, but we're about to hear from Fabien Cousteau, who's part of a project called Mission 31. He and a team of scientists have been living and conducting research at an underwater base for the past 31 days. They're submerged 63 feet off the Florida Keys and they're returning to the surface today. Now, if Cousteau's name sounds familiar, there's a reason. It was Fabien's grandfather, Jacques, who pioneered the idea of living underwater to do research. His famous first mission was 50 years ago. His grandson was marking that anniversary, and we reached Fabien yesterday. I asked him to describe this underwater base.
The marine laboratory that we're in right now is about the size of a school bus, and inside it is everything that we need that's contained. So our life support system, our cameras, our science equipment, dive gear, and everything else. It's separated into four sections. The two main sections are the sleeping quarters and the living quarters. And then beyond that, we have a dry lab where we perform a lot of the experiments. And then finally, on the opposite end of where the bunk room is our wet porch, my favorite part of the habitat, because it's our front door to the ocean world. It's on the floor, and there are stairs leading into the water. And I love being able to just walk into the ocean.
You know, I was reading about what you're doing. Your body pressurizes in a way that, when you're down there for a long period of time, that lets you take much longer dives. Isn't that right?
That's the real luxury and benefit of living on the frontier, is being able to be there. My grandfather used to say, in order to film a fish, you have to become a fish, and this is the best way to do it.
What's one of the best memories of one of these long dives?
Well, I've never seen a Goliath grouper strike a barracuda, which we had the unbelievable luck to see right outside this viewport.
Is that a violent confrontation?
It was quite violent. It was a territorial behavior. There were scales flying and everything else. Other things like being unbelievably lucky to have spotted eagle rays flying around the habitat for the last almost 31 days. I see them as our escorts and guardians throughout the mission. I mean, it's just been a wonderful and magical experience.
What do these escorts look like?
Spotted eagle rays are a medium-sized ray with, as their name implies, spots all over the top of their bodies. They are anywhere from 4 to 6 foot in wingspan and with a tail that can be as much as 8 to 10 feet long.
Wow.
They have been hanging around here for the entirety of the mission, which is extraordinarily unusual.
You did a lot of experiments while you were underwater for these 31 days. Is there one that stands out that you think our listeners would sort of learn something from hearing about?
As far as the science is concerned, we've been able to leverage a lot of the latest, greatest in technologies to find out more about what's happening to our coral reefs. And this is such an amazing, fabulous fireworks display of life down here, and we barely scratched the surface. And I'm looking out the window right now. Sorry, I got distracted. I see three spotted eagle rays flying right in front of the viewport right now, and it is just an amazing sight. I will never tire of this, even after 31 days or 31 years. It's just a beautiful sight.
Maybe some of your escorts, your friends there, are saying goodbye.
I think that might be the case.
Well, Fabien, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Best of luck on your journey back up to the surface, and congratulations on the project.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Armed with new drilling technology, oil companies are looking to Florida. They're returning to long-dormant oil fields near the Everglades, and one county is fighting the state in court over that drilling. Commissioners in Collier County charge that state regulators have been lax in their oversight of the new drilling methods, jeopardizing public health and the environment. NPR's Greg Allen has the story.
This is the site that's at the center of the dispute between Collier County and Florida's Department of Environmental Protection. Several hundred yards from where I'm standing, the Dan A. Hughes Company is drilling an exploratory well. In December, Danielle Irwin with Florida's DEP says the company used an unauthorized procedure to look for oil.
There are a number of different names. It goes by acidification, acidizing, acid stimulation, acid fracking. So all of those names generally are talking about that process.
Acid has long been used in oil drilling operations in Florida to dissolve and loosen the limestone bedrock. But the drilling operation near Naples, on the western edge of the Everglades, was something new. The acid was injected under pressure. It's a process not used before in Florida. Florida regulators asked the drilling company to suspend the operation while the state studied the process. The company refused.
Within a matter of hours after we realized that the process was going forward, I issued the cease and desist order.
Secretary of Florida's Department of Environmental Protection, Herschel Vineyard, says despite the cease and desist order, the company continued the work anyway and completed its operation. Eventually, Florida and the driller signed a consent agreement. The company agreed to pay a $25,000 fine and install groundwater monitors. But in Collier County, where local officials, residents, and environmental groups had already been raising concerns about the new drilling, the dispute between the Dan A. Hughes Company and the state remained secret. More than 3 months after the cease and desist order was issued, Collier County officials finally learned about it through a press release.
One of the frustrations with the Board of County Commissioners is all of the information that we've been receiving has been through the media.
Tim Nance is a Collier County Commissioner. There have been oil wells in this area for more than 70 years. What's raised concerns now are the new technologies, horizontal drilling and advanced extraction techniques, and what risk they pose to the area's groundwater. County commissioners asked state officials for a public meeting without success. Finally, Collier County went to court asking the state to revoke the oil driller's permit. It's similar to legal action to block fracking taken by local governments in other states like California, Colorado, and New York. In Florida, Nance says the state needs to tighten regulation of drilling before the new oil boom goes any further.
Frankly, I'm very, very concerned about how well sites in the future that are near residential properties are going to be managed. That's my number one concern.
To try to allay concerns of county officials and residents, Florida's Department of Environmental Resources recently installed its own groundwater monitors and says preliminary results show no evidence of contamination. Jennifer Hecker with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, an environmental group, isn't reassured. She says the state needs to install deeper monitors below the aquifer where Florida draws most of its drinking water. But Hecker says there's a larger problem. Florida, she says, isn't ready for the new oil drilling technologies.
We have some very antiquated oil and gas regs that were written long ago when these techniques didn't even really exist or were used.
Florida's oil and gas regulations currently make no mention of acid stimulation, hydraulic fracturing, or other new extraction technologies. The Dan A. Hughes Company says that's why it believes its operations are allowed under Florida law. Hecker says regulators and lawmakers need to take action before approving more drilling permits.
This horizontal drilling, the use of all of these chemicals, the high-pressure injection of those chemicals, that's a whole different process than what we have traditionally seen here in Collier County. So we need to update the laws and regulations.
On this last point, at least, state regulators, local officials, and environmental groups agree. Environmental Protection Secretary Vineyard says he's asked his staff to develop recommendations on updating Florida's oil and gas regulations. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.